Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Last summer, in the final months of the Trump administration, the Department of the Interior approved a plan to build a 211-mile road to the Ambler Mining District in northwestern Alaska. The road would enable the extraction of more than 43 million tons of copper and zinc over at least 12 years. If the Ambler Road is built, it will cross nearly 3,000 streams, 11 major rivers, 1,700 acres of wetlands, and a major caribou migration corridor, which is a primary source of food for Alaska's native people in the Arctic. Environmentalists and some native communities have voiced their opposition and have warned that the construction of this road will damage and fragment miles and miles of natural habitats, impact food security, water quality, and access to hunting and fishing, and destroy and pollute the Alaskan ecosystem. Today's guest, award-winning journalist Adam Fetterman, has taken a deep look at the impacts of this project. In his feature article for Politico and Type Investigations called How Joe Biden's Green Agenda Threatens the Alaskan Wilderness, he writes, "Large quantities of rare earth metals and other minerals, including copper, are needed for electric vehicles, solar panels, wind turbines, and batteries, all critical to achieving the administration's ambitious green energy goals. Over the next few decades, global demand for copper is expected to soar by as much as 270%, with the needs of manufacturers, according to an estimate, outstripping supply by the year 2050. The Biden administration has been conspicuously silent on the Ambler Road project, showing no intent to interrupt the approval process despite vocal opposition from multiple groups in Alaska." Later in the show, PJ Simon, chief and chairman of the Tanana Chiefs Conference, will tell us why Native communities oppose the project. Adam Fetterman reports opposition to the road among Alaska Natives, who make up about 15% of the state's 731,000 population and are spread across a vast area rather than concentrated on reservations, is not unanimous. Joining us now is Adam Fetterman, a Type Investigations Fellow. His articles about public lands and environmental policies have appeared in many publications, including The Guardian and The Nation. Hi, Adam. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on and devoting time to this issue.
Well, thank you for writing about such an important topic. In many ways, we are all very connected to this because there's so much demand now for copper and zinc. You and photographer Nathaniel Wilder traveled to Alaska for this investigation, and you spoke with a number of people about this project. How long have you been on this story, and how did you first learn about it?
I'd been paying attention to the Ambler Road project sort of from a distance for, you know, several years as it evolved under the previous administration. I mean, it is interesting to note that it is a major development project in Alaska that has not gotten the kind of attention or scrutiny as, you know, something like the wildlife refuge or oil and gas development in general on the North Slope. So it was always of interest to me, but I did not appreciate the complexity or the magnitude of the potential impact if this road is built and the mines that are proposed are ultimately developed.
Can you tell us a little bit about this area? I hope that listeners take some time to look at the photos in the piece. I mean, it looks like just such a stunning, gorgeous area.
It's magnificent, and I wish I could do it justice by describing it, but it's actually quite challenging, in part because the scale and the breadth of sort of territory that the road would run through. I mean, it's the network of rivers is really extraordinary. And I wasn't prepared for that until I was able to really sort of see it, and also to be able to see it from aerial photos that Nathaniel took for the story. But as you mentioned in your intro, you know, the road would cross thousands of rivers, including, you know, wild and scenic rivers in Gates of the Arctic National Park. It's one of the largest roadless areas in North America. south of the Brooks Range, which is where many of these rivers are flowing out of. And it's also an area that's been inhabited for thousands of years by Alaska Natives who continue to use the river ecosystem and to hunt and live off of the land, you know, in what is obviously an extremely remote and hard to get to place.
You know, given that this is such a major project and would have huge consequences, why hasn't this gotten more attention, do you think?
That's a very hard question to answer. I think it may have something to do with the fact that interior Alaska remains relatively unexplored, I guess, by you know, those who don't travel to or who don't live in Alaska. I also think that the project has been evolving for over a decade now. So just the fact that it takes so long to get something like this off the ground has maybe muted some of the urgency around what it would actually mean. And even as we're talking now, you know, the estimate for breaking ground on the road is not for at least another 3, perhaps 4 years. So I think that may be part of it. But as we approach that moment and as the Department of the Interior makes, you know, the final decisions really that are needed to approve the road and crossing of a national park, et cetera, you know, I think we're going to see much more attention on this issue. And of course, in the context of mining in general, as you know, the United States and other major industrialized countries, you know, try to build out this so-called green economy, you know, and what that means for open space and biodiversity. So I think it's going to change, but it's absolutely correct that it has not really broken through yet.
Well, and then the numbers are incredible. I mean, as you report, global demand for copper is expected to soar by as much as 270%. I mean, there's a huge push for electric cars, for solar panels, for wind turbines, but you need copper in order for that to happen.
Right. I mean, the demand is, you know, it's inarguable. And it poses a dilemma. I mean, I think this is part of what the Biden administration is grappling with now and will be for the rest of, you know, the first term and possible second term. You know, how to address many of the issues that are emerging with a project like this and still sort of push their agenda to, you know, convert the federal, you know, vehicle fleet to electric vehicles, for example. So that's part of the reason why I wanted to write the story as well, because I think it's different from the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, which the Biden administration has, you know, suspended leases in that area. And I think we don't actually know yet how they're going to handle the Ambler Road litigation, because they haven't had to file their response yet, but we'll see.
So let's talk about a little bit of background here. You write that the Ambler's underground riches are so highly prized that when the gates of the Arctic National Park were created in 1980, the Alaska delegation made sure a provision for possible road access across the park was written into the legislation. Have there been other attempts before the Trump administration to build a road there?
There's been speculation and interest, but the formal process of initiating the application for getting a right of way, as far as I know, was not started until the early 2010s. Around then, and it started out as an Alaska Department of Transportation project, and then was turned over to the state-owned corporation that is now currently behind the project. And there were a lot of problems, actually, with the initial application. It did not meet many of the requirements that it needed to, but was resubmitted just before the previous administration came into office. And then after that, it was really fast-tracked. And the state, it's a project that the state has wanted to see come to fruition for for over a decade. And I think they realized that the stars had aligned under the Trump administration, and they were able to get a very complex environmental impact statement completed without a lot of the information that, you know, environmental advocates and the Tanana Chiefs Conference argue should have been available before they made that kind of determination.
Right. You report that the Trump administration pushed career Interior Department employees to modify findings that showed the Ambler Road project's potential for widespread environmental damage. And this is according to documents and interviews with current and former employees.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they downplayed at every opportunity the impacts to the environment and to the subsistence way of life. You know, I got a draft document of the environmental impact statement that had been marked up by the former BLM, Bureau of Land Management, Alaska State Director, which basically argued that the BLM employees were making too much of impact to the environment and subsistence and everything else. And that was reflected in the final, you know, decision that the administration made to approve the road with what, you know, what critics argue are not the kind of safeguards and mitigation requirements that should be in place for a project of this scope.
The road, according to Ambler mining interests, would enable the extraction of more than 43 million tons of copper and zinc over at least 12 years. How accurate is that estimate? How could you fact check that their claim?
Well, so the Ambler Mining District in the northwestern part of the state, which is where the road would terminate. I mean, it's a 211-mile road that connects this mining belt with the Dalton Highway and eventually Fairbanks and railways or ports south of there. So the Ambler Mining District has been studied and evaluated for a very long time, since at least the early 1960s. And that figure comes from the most advanced mining project within that district, which is called the Arctic Mine. So in fact, that number is almost certainly a significant underestimate of how much would be extracted from that region. And one of the things that I wanted to make clear in the story is that the road is designed to open up not just this Ambler mining district, but the entire sort of interior region to mineral and rare earth metal development, which is why I think the potential impacts are far greater than even what I've outlined in this story.
What does it take to extract these metals? What is involved?
Well, I mean, copper and hard rock mining, you know, it's been going on for quite a long time. And, you know, the companies will argue that their methods have improved, but, you know, the track record is not great. And in Alaska in particular, hard rock mines are, I think, the leading source of toxic waste pollution in Alaska rivers. You know, these are open pit mines. So it's has leaves a significant footprint and requires storage of waste and toxic tailings for, you know, really in perpetuity. I mean, they mine, they get everything they can, and then they have to leave these toxic tailings ponds, you know, in very remote places that are difficult to manage and sort of maintain safety and all the rest. So I think that those long-term impacts of this kind of mining are also, you know, quite significant. And it's not something that I get into in a lot of detail in the story, in part because I was focusing primarily on the road. And, you know, you do have to distinguish between these two elements, but in the end, you're going to have the impacts of both. You're going to have a 211-mile road crossing this, you know, remote wilderness region, and then you're going to have a lot of open pit mining and who knows what else down the road.
Okay, so just to focus on the road then, as you report in this piece, the road would transform a vast region of Alaskan wilderness, potentially disrupting the migration patterns of the state's largest caribou herd and polluting some of the state's most important spawning grounds for salmon and white fish. It would also threaten the way of life of Alaskan natives who've lived in the region for thousands of years. So just tell us more about what you dug up about how this road would really transform the area.
Yeah, and I'm sure PJ can talk more about impacts to Alaska Native communities, but I spent some time with PJ in one of these little villages called Allakaket, which is on one of the big rivers, the Koyukuk. And, fishing is really central to the way of life there. And road construction and everything that goes along with it, from gravel mining to the construction of bridges and thousands of culverts, as well as, potential accidents from trucks carrying copper, could really just imperil some of these waterways. It's part of the Yukon River watershed, so it is an important salmon spawning region, and also sheepfish, a kind of whitefish, is crucial to sort of the way of life in that region. So, impacts to fish and waterways would be inevitable, and we don't, obviously there are a lot of variables in terms of what kinds of impacts there may be, but I think that's something that is sort of at the top of the list of concerns that people who live and live off of the land in that region have.
Today, we're speaking with Adam Fetterman, a Type Investigations Fellow who is out with a piece in Politico and Type Investigations, How Joe Biden's Green Agenda Threatens the Alaskan Wilderness. And we are talking about a 211-mile industrial access road that would run across much of interior Alaska to the Ambler Mining District, a massive but remote deposit of high-grade copper and zinc. Global demand for copper is expected to soar by as much as 270%. It's needed for electric cars, for solar panels, wind turbines. And we really need to be having a conversation about this as people are turning to electric cars and solar panels. We have to talk about where this copper is going to come from and how it is going to affect the land and the people who rely on the land, in this case, Alaska Natives. If you have any questions or comments for Adam, in about 10 minutes, PJ Simon, chief of the Tanana Chiefs Conference, will tell us why some Native communities oppose this project. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Adam, can you tell us more about some of the companies involved here? Because we talk about mining, but we rarely name some of the companies. Are any of these companies familiar to people?
They probably not. They're relatively small. I mean, it's an unusual partnership in that the state of Alaska is also involved in the development of the road, and they are the official applicant on the right of way for the right of way permit. But basically, at the moment, two companies are involved. One is a Canadian mining company called Trilogy Metals, and the other is an Australian company called South 32, and they recently formed a partnership and are called Ambler Metals. They are helping to finance some of the road construction, but they are primarily involved in, research and exploration, basically evaluating these mineral deposits and raising, money to fund their development project. So it was interesting when I was out there, actually, the South 32, the Australian company, had a camp set up sort of toward the eastern edge of the proposed road, doing exploration work in a remote area near another river. And I also have heard, and actually Trilogy has since reported that they are also looking at additional deposits along sort of the road corridor. So I think part of what they do is, you know, they have to continue to promote the idea that there's more and more potential out there in order to raise capital to finance what is a hugely expensive, you know, road development project and mining venture that won't actually start producing anything for probably another decade.
We'll get into this more in the second half of the show, but can you tell us more about what you're hearing from the Department of the Interior? As you report, officials at Interior have continued to process permits for pre-development work this summer, including geotechnical drilling at proposed bridge sites on three major rivers.
That's right. Interior has been pretty quiet on this issue, and they declined to answer questions for my story because of ongoing litigation. I would say the only real development since my story came out is that the department did request a 60-day stay in the litigation. So there are two lawsuits challenging BLM's approval of the road, and it was something of a surprise that the department wanted another couple of months to consult with interested parties. But it's still unclear if they are planning to take a different course. So they've been quiet, and we won't really know what next steps are until they file their response in the case.
Have you heard anything from Interior Secretary Deb Haaland on this project?
Well, her name came up quite a bit when I was out there. The feeling, you know, there's a lot of support for her and her confirmation as Interior Secretary. There was a lot of hope. You know, she had been planning a trip to Alaska in September before things got worse with the Delta variant, and that trip was canceled. So there was some hope, and I believe a formal request that she meet with members of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. And I do know that DOI and the White House have been having consultations with Tanana Chiefs Conference and others who are concerned about this project. So they are clearly listening. They're aware of what the concerns are, and you know, the question now is, does that translate into, meaningful action? We'll see.
Before the break, can you tell us about the lawsuit that was brought by nine environmental groups? They allege that the Department of Interior did not have key information it needed, including detailed mapping of wetlands for a 50-mile portion of the road.
Yeah, you know, I've reported on a number of land use issues in Alaska, and I have to say that the NEPA process for Ambler Road was probably the sort of the least rigorous, and has what I would argue are a lot of just very obvious flaws, including the fact that they didn't have a lot of the information that they should have when they, you know, were making their determinations about impacts and everything else. You know, the first 50 miles of the road, they don't even have wetland mapping yet, and that's sort of essential to understanding the potential impacts might be. So they're kind of playing catch up. They've given the state the luxury of being able to do a number of these assessments and surveys sort of after the approvals were granted. And I think that in many ways is the crux of the lawsuit.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are joined by Adam Fetterman, a Type Investigations Fellow. We're talking about the piece he wrote for Politico and Type Investigations, how Joe Biden's green agenda threatens the Alaskan wilderness. We're talking about a 211-mile industrial access road that would run across much of Interior Alaska to the Ambler Mining District, a massive but remote deposit of high-grade copper and zinc. Global demand for copper is expected to soar by as much as 270% over the next few decades. It's needed for everything from electric cars to solar panels. The road crosses, or would cross, nearly 3,000, the road does cross, 3,000 streams, 1,700 acres of wetlands, and a major caribou migration corridor. After the break, we'll be joined by PJ Simon, chief and chairman of the Tanana Chiefs Conference, and he'll tell us why Native communities oppose this project. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we're joined by Adam Fetterman, a Type Investigations Fellow, and we're talking about Adam's recent really important piece for Politico and Type Investigations, how Joe Biden's green agenda threatens the Alaskan wilderness. We're talking about a proposed 211-mile industrial access road that would run across much of interior Alaska to the Ambler Mining District, a massive but remote deposit of high-grade copper and zinc. The road would enable the extraction of more than 43 million tons of copper and zinc over at least 12 years. The road crosses 3,000 streams, 11 major rivers, 1,700 acres of wetlands, and major caribou migration corridor. It would transform one of Alaska's wildest places and would threaten the way of life of Alaska natives who've lived in the region for thousands of years. Adam, we're just waiting to connect with PJ Simon, the chief of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Tell us what you heard from, I mean, obviously there's not one opinion from Native communities, but what really struck you about what you are hearing from Native communities in Alaska?
It is a complex picture. The communities that I was in, including Allakaket with PJ, are part of one of the lawsuits challenging BLM's approval of the road. And they have come out, you know, in opposition to the road. As you get further west to the Ambler Mining District, where the road would terminate, I think the villages there tend to be a little bit more divided. I had actually been planning to get to one of those villages called Kobuk, but at the very last minute, they basically said that they weren't allowing visitors to travel there. But I think there may have been a lot of sort of political maneuvering involved. It is important to point out and acknowledge the role that Native corporations play in some of these land use issues. And one of them, Nana Corporation, is quite influential and directly involved in one of the mining deposits and has a partnership with Trilogy Metals, the Canadian company that's, you know, behind the road. So they have a vested interest in seeing this come to fruition. And I think that, you know, affects how things play out in some of these villages, including Kobuk and two of the other villages out there, Ambler and Shungnak.
Can you tell us more about this, more about these Native corporations and what the relationship would be like with these mining companies?
Yeah, I mean, it's a hugely important part of Alaska land use issues and politics. I mean, the Native corporations were created in 1971. It's actually coming up on the 50th anniversary in December. And basically, in exchange for extinguishing Aboriginal land rights in Alaska, the corporations were granted millions of acres of territory and also a sizable chunk of money. So they have enormous power and influence, and many of the Alaska natives who live in these villages are also shareholders in these corporations, so they do benefit to some extent. At the same time, though, you know, the decisions that the corporations make are not always in line with what village folks and Alaska natives want. And I think we see that with the Ambler Road project. There is a lot of opposition. There's opposition in the Nana villages. And I mean, Kobuk, for example, was actually a party to the lawsuit challenging BLM's approval of the road early on, the Kobuk Tribal Council. And it's remained somewhat unclear why, but they ended up withdrawing from that lawsuit. So I think it's a huge part of this story, and it's going to be significant in terms of how the Department of the Interior handles things going forward.
You know, when these types of projects go to these remote places, Can you just tell us how it affects people on the ground? I mean, people who don't have political clout, people who are not connected to these corporations.
Well, I think that the way that these projects unfold and the decision-making process is often, leaves those who live in these communities sort of standing on the side. And I mean, logistically, it's very difficult to get to these places. And I do think that under the Trump administration, there was not a great deal of interest in tribal consultation. So they did sort of the bare minimum. And I think that's something that the Tanana Chiefs Conference has talked about. And certainly when I was in Allakaket, you know, there was a lot of intense interest in this project and what its impacts would be, but also a sense that they had not been able to voice those concerns and really sort of have their input included.
What about some of the villages? I mean, you spoke to a number of people on the ground. Can you tell us how, you know, villagers are responding to all of this?
Yeah, well, I mean, Allakaket, there was a community meeting when I was there, and PJ was there as well. But a number of people spoke about impacts to caribou, for example, and a lot of the elders actually talked about the fact that when the Dalton Highway was built to connect Prudhoe Bay to Fairbanks, it impacted caribou migration. Coming west toward the region that they live in, and sort of how that significant historical event has sort of shaped land use patterns and way of life in Allakaket, and in the context of what this new road would mean both to caribou and also other resources. Unfortunately, I didn't get to Kobuk. I did meet with someone from Kobuk when I was in Fairbanks who is strongly opposed to the project. But I do think that generally speaking, there is a feeling of not having been meaningfully consulted on this project and wanting to have a voice in sort of how things move forward.
We have a listener who wants to know if you spoke with anyone on the ground about what this copper will actually be used for, electric cars, for example, wind turbines?
That's a great question, actually. I mean, not really. It's quite something when you are on the ground in a remote part of Alaska like this, because, there's no running water. There's a washateria where you can go to do your laundry, and the needs are very basic, and they're not being met. So I think the idea that they would be part of something that's going to create, or help build the so-called green economy is very abstract. When you don't have sort of basic infrastructure and services in your own village.
Yeah, actually, I just watched a PBS NewsHour piece about high-speed internet in certain parts of Alaska and how people had a really hard time getting their education because they just didn't have access. And there's this one company that's coming in to provide high-speed internet for the first time. I also wanted to ask you one more question about the Biden administration. You report that in early June, the administration said that it was establishing a task force to address the supply of critical minerals and emphasize the need to scale up domestic production to meet national and global climate standards. Mm-hmm. When do you think we might be hearing from the administration on that issue, and then more specifically about this Ambler Road project?
Well, I don't know where things stand precisely with this task force. I mean, it's been clear from day one that the Biden administration has been promoting this idea of sort of developing a domestic supply chain for critical minerals, because, it's not just the mining itself, but processing and everything else that goes along with it that would have to be, put in place before any of this stuff would actually be realized. But we see this conflict playing out in other places too. I mean, the Thacker Pass mine in Nevada, for example, lithium mine, and other lithium prospects in Nevada are slowly sort of emerging as flashpoints for the Biden administration, forcing people to really think critically about what it means to sacrifice open space and biodiversity, in the name of so-called green economy. What does that mean? What will it look like, and whose voices will be listened to?
It is such an important point and something that we really need to talk about, because in many ways, especially people who live in cities, we're just so disconnected from where these minerals actually come from. And again, I just wanted to read from your piece. We're talking again today about Ambler Road. It's a 211-mile Ambler Road would cut across one of the largest roadless areas in North America. I mean, that's amazing to think about. One of the largest roadless areas in North America, crossing hundreds of rivers and streams and potentially impacting caribou migration patterns and some of Alaska's most important salmon and shefish spawning streams. Alaska natives who've lived in the region for thousands of years are concerned that the road will undermine their way of life and threaten the subsistence resources they depend on. What sort of response have you received from this piece, given that this issue is not getting that much attention?
Well, I haven't gotten a ton of feedback. I did get some amusing emails from a couple of folks in Alaska who sort of said, in probably words I can't use on the radio, that I should not return. And I do think that point of view needs to be heard. There is support for this project in Alaska. I don't want to make it seem like there isn't. And the state is very gung-ho. Obviously, they're pouring huge amounts of money into what many believe might, ultimately be a boondoggle. But, there is a significant faction that supports mining and this kind of development in Alaska. I do think that the story helped a little bit to just kind of put this project on the map, and I do hope that people will think about what it means to mine for rare earth metals or minerals needed for the transition away from fossil fuels. I think that as we were just discussing, that issue is just sort of beginning to kind of rise to the surface.
Well, we're still trying to connect with PJ Simon, a chief and chair of the Tanana Chiefs Conference, and we'll let you know when we do, hopefully soon. We have an email, and I'll definitely ask PJ Simon this question, from Sandy, who says, building the road and mining camps means male work camps. Let's be frank. Don't these camps contribute to the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women? Adam, did you talk to anyone about this? Because anytime we do a show about oil pipelines, the issue around man camps always comes up.
It's an important question. I mean, I think one thing to point out in the context of Ambler Road is that there really is no industrial development in this region. So even the notion of having man camps or something like that would be sort of extraordinary. Trilogy and some of the other mining companies have been, doing exploration work, up in the Ambler mining district. And obviously I wasn't able to get there. They do have a camp in that area. And they say in their promotional material that they're trying as best they can to hire, local Alaska natives from these villages. So I don't really feel like I can speak to the existing dynamic between, say, Trilogy Metals and Alaska Natives in Kobuk and Ambler and Shungnak, but clearly it's a concern. And just I think another example of something that probably has not been, thought through in the way that it should be before a project like this gets the green light.
Well, thank you for the question, Sandy. And if we do connect with PJ Simon, we'll definitely ask him. Let's go to a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. Hopefully it's not too much feedback.
Oh, there's a bit of feedback, Greg. Can you just turn your radio down?
The phone. I mean, hold on a sec. I'll turn it down. Sorry.
There you go. Go ahead, Greg. Greg, are you there?
Anyway, yeah. My response was a couple of things. In the past year, I've begun to wonder whether or not the technological fixes for the climate crisis that we're in were really going to be all that they were made out to be. I mean, I'm not opposed to electric vehicles or solar panels. I think they're part of the mix. But it seems to me that trying to square this project and everything else that's going on with what just happened in Glasgow is really tough. I mean, because the price that's going to get paid for these technological fixes is going to be high, and you can see that from your discussion today. So it just makes me think that I'm starting to be on the side of the people who are now just saying that this COP26 was just a total failure. And I just can't see how we're going to get to where we would like to be simply by going down this route of the technological fixes. So this has raised serious concerns in my mind, and somebody's going to be paying a price for this, and it's going to be the native people, people in the global south, etc. So just a comment, and love to hear if you have a response.
Thank you. Adam, any response on that one? I mean, we're definitely going to do an entire show about this because it's so important.
Oh, it's an excellent point. And I agree completely that the idea that, you know, electric vehicles are going to save us from, you know, catastrophic climate change is a fantasy. And I also think the point that Greg made is really interesting in the context of how these companies are greenwashing what they do, because they are seizing on the idea that they're developing green metals and they're going to sort of realize this dream of a green economy by doing the kinds of development projects that we're talking about right now. And, you know, the onus is clearly on the fossil fuel industry to, you know, phase out and stop burning coal, oil, and gas, et cetera, and exploring for it. But we do really have to look critically at these projects and question whether, you know, the necessity of mining, you know, the hell out of the earth to sort of advance this, you know, progressive notion. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a crucial question.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Greg. We'll definitely do a show about this. Adam Fetterman is a Type Investigations Fellow. We're talking about the piece he wrote for Politico and Type Investigations, how Joe Biden's green agenda threatens the Alaskan wilderness. And now we'd like to welcome PJ Simon, Chief and Chair of the Tanana Chiefs Conference, a consortium of 37 federally recognized tribes. The Tanana Chiefs Conference have sued the Department of the Interior over its handling of the Ambler Road environmental impact statement. Hi, Chief Simon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on with Adam Fetterman. Yes, Tanana Chiefs Conference is a consortium of 37 tribes, and we are federally recognized in the heart of Alaska, beautiful interior Alaska.
Well, Chief Simon, can you first tell us just what this area looks like? I mean, the photos in Adam's piece are just stunning. Give us a sense of what this area is like.
This area is the last pristine place in the United States. It's federal public land, so you own it just as much as I own it. And being Alaska Native, my people have subsistence has lived in this area for thousands of years, and we have been good stewards of the environment, the flora, the fauna. This is such a beautiful place. There's dull sheep at 5,000 foot in the mountains. We hunt and people take pictures. There's a good balance. It's the second, the river, Alapna River, is the second largest whitefish cisco spawnery in Alaska. And four species of cisco, sheepfish, which we live on year-round, also three herds of caribou that migrate through there, Tusuktuk herd, the western Arctic caribou herd, the central Arctic caribou herd, and then if we go south, we've got the Ray Mountain caribou herd. So we have a lot of salmon. 15% of the whole Yukon River chum run spawns above Alakak in Alaska, which is beautiful to see, crystal clear waters. And 10, 11 years ago, there was a project to build a road in the Southern Brooks Range, which pierces right through the heart of the region and would threaten a lot of our flora and fauna. The users of the outdoors, floaters, recreational people, the Alaska natives, the way we live would all be threatened and unraveled by a road for minerals. And on top of that, if you look at the Canadian mining companies that's trying to get mining claims in there, and the Australian mining companies that get in there, they have not reached out to any of the federally recognized tribes to say, hey, we're building a road right through your traditional homeland. And out there is where we harvest our food, where beautiful people that live off the land. And for this to happen, I'll just use an example. If you go to the food mart, or if you go to a shopping center, you can get everything you need in that one square acre. Up here in Alaska, where it's beautiful and wild, you just don't go to one gravel bar along a river and find a moose, a caribou, a sheep, salmon, whitefish. You have to use the whole generalized area for subsisting, living off the land. And that's where we're so concerned the federal agencies did not do a proper government-to-government as required by federal agencies. They did not meet with us.
Chair Simon, that's the question I wanted to ask you, because in the lawsuit against the Department of the Interior, you argue that the department did not uphold its obligation to meaningfully consult with the tribes. Have you heard from them at all?
No, actually, I believe this court case is in the office of the Department of Interior Secretary. So with the trust doctrine that the federal government has a trust responsibility with American Indian, Alaska Native, federally recognized tribes, we feel, the plaintiffs, that we did not get a fair shake. We did not get that government-to-government consultation, which with such a large project would devastate the way we live. All we're asking for is the government-to-government and to renew the EIS process. That way we are more at the table, so to speak, than just being told what to do or how is it going to be. But we're federally recognized tribes, and the Interior, they know, we know that process was flawed. Therefore, we filed a lawsuit against the Interior.
Chairman Simon, in our last minute, can you tell us how this massive project would affect the land and the tribes? I mean, to think that this is a 211-mile project cutting across one of the largest roadless areas in North America, crossing hundreds of rivers and streams, impacting caribou migration patterns. I mean, what would this do to the tribes and the land?
That would short-circuit our way of life. We live off the land right now. It's beautiful. We love living out there. You know, there's recreational users that come from all over the world and all over the states. They're not building roads. They're floating. They're recreating. So as we live off the land in harmony, it's scary. Once you build, this is the biggest fight in Alaska that's not making the news. So we're trying to protect our homeland and go through the due diligence as required by the United States government with the trust responsibility. And we're telling them, you have not honored your trust responsibility, and we did not get a proper government-to-government consultation.
And as we move to embrace these technologies like electric vehicles and wind turbines, you need copper for all of that, Chairman Simon. So can you just talk in our last minute what role you all would like to play in that conversation as things start to change?
As the world changes, you know, there's one electric vehicle for every 750 gas-guzzling vehicles out there. Of course, we need balance. Of course, we have to address climate change, but also the United States government has to address the tribes that they have a trust responsibility with. And, you know, we all have TVs. We all have amenities of modern culture, but it's respecting the flora and fauna. And again, this is federal public land. You own it just as much as I do. We have native inholdings in this area. We have, state inholdings. But this BLM process, Bureau of Land Management, that's federal public land. That's United States public property. So we're just saying, hey, throttle back a little bit. Grant the new EIS to give us time to sit down at the table with the players and make the best decision on the go forward that would protect the renewable resources, protect the culture, and protect the flora and fauna of the Southern Brooks Range.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Chairman Simon. We'd love to have you back. We will definitely follow this issue.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, thank you so much. And a big hello to Adam Fetterman.
Thank you. PJ Simon is chief and chair of the Tanana Chiefs Conference, a consortium of 37 federally recognized tribes in Alaska. Adam, before we let you go, just briefly, is there any public comment on this or what's next on this? Can people raise their voices?
They can certainly raise their voices. I mean, the next step is the litigation, how DOI responds to the briefs filed by plaintiffs, including Tanana Chiefs Conference. And the DOI's deadline is January 21st. So at that stage, we'll have a much better understanding of where this issue is headed.
Adam Fetterman is an independent journalist. We've been talking about his Politico-type investigations piece, How Joe Biden's Green Agenda Threatens the Alaskan Wilderness. Adam, thanks so much for your important reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.